Welcome to In Context's War Report. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. With me is In Context's military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe. Marshawn, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
In today's program, entitled Defending America, we're going to critically examine current U.S. military policy and address some fundamental questions, such as, what is the principal mission of a nation's armed forces? And is current U.S. military policy well-suited to carrying out that mission? Then Marchand is going to discuss in detail significant proposed changes to U.S. military policy, which he believes would greatly strengthen the ability of our military to defend the country. So let's get started with the most basic question. What would you say, Marchand, is the principal mission of a nation's military?
Well, national defense above all else. I mean, if you can't defend your own borders, the military kind of becomes, well, every other mission in the military becomes a moot point. The whole purpose of a military is whether it's to defend the empire, defend the realm, it's to defend the homeland first. That's why you had modern organized armies develop. We can trace the legitimate standing army back to the days of Rome. Rome is really the father of the modern standing army, and it was created to defend the city, the Senate, and the people of Rome. Eventually went on to defend the empire, but the Roman army ceased to exist once it could no longer defend Rome. When Rome was sacked and burned, the Roman army basically dissolved and ceased to exist, with the exception of the Byzantine.
It's often said that the U.S. Army is older than the United States itself. It was dated prior to the founding of the Republic.
Yeah, the founding of the United States Army is 1775, so with the colonial militia and everything.
So we had an army before we had a country.
Well, exactly. And I think that fundamentally says something about the American psyche. You know, General Patton once said that Americans love to fight. They love the sting of battle. And it's true. I mean, we really did have an army before we had a nation, because we were fighting, on the one hand, the Indians and the French, and then on the other, fighting the English was an afterthought. It was really predominantly fighting the Indians and the French. So we were a country, especially as a colony, born out of war. So the military was essentially, it was an essential aspect of American life.
And it really until 1898, until the war against Spain, we pretty much stayed at home. We followed the policy of Washington and Jefferson to avoid foreign wars. So Jefferson paid a very pretty high price to stay out of the War of 1812. But in any event, if you look at the map today, you consider the fact that the United States has been involved in wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya. We have numerous training missions to places as far away as Africa. How do these military involvements impact the principal mission of the military to defend the United States?
We've always been an expansionist nation. It's only natural that we'd eventually become expansionist outside our own sphere of influence, because before 1898, we were driving west, taking over the Mexican territories and, you know, pushing out the Indians and expanding, you know, Manifest Destiny all the way to the coast. Well, then afterwards, we decided, you know what, we're going to expand beyond that. You know, we want to become an empire like our European brothers across the sea. So we start to expand. And like any other empire does, really before Vietnam, our military was capable of defending our empire overseas as well as our home, because we had made up our mind, we want to be an empire. Before the Spanish-American War, after we'd conquered everything to California, we decided we want to play the empire game. We beat the Spanish, and then we decided we want to be like the Europeans. So we had these, you know, concessions in China. We controlled the Philippines. We controlled Cuba, places like that. But we had an army that was capable, because our army was large, it was capable of defending our colonies and defending our homeland. After Vietnam, this really persisted up until Vietnam. After Vietnam, we developed this idea that, well, we aren't an empire. We don't want to be an empire. We want to spread democracy, 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 but we don't want to be an empire. And we kind of split with the quote-unquote imperialists. We, in fact, worked to help disassemble the European imperialists in favor of democracy. We're going to create democratic regimes in Africa and the rest of the world. Well, when in reality, we just simply replaced European colonial rulers with despots. It's a modern form of empire. It's just, it's on the cheap. It doesn't require you to have as massive a military. After Vietnam, this is something Ian Smith, the former prime minister of Rhodesia, wrote about, was that the problem with American empire is that it's corporate. They just want the natural resources. The American idea of empire is not about spreading civilization, which is really what all of the European empires and even Asiatic empires purportedly espoused, albeit they didn't actually, in many cases, implement it, but that's what they espoused. The American goal was simply get a compliant anti-communist dictator that would keep the Soviets out. Really, that was the American goal. Well, the Soviet Union collapses. You know, we move on into the 21st century and you have your wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Well, the problem is now you're starting to move more into direct warfare. You know, when you're toppling, you know, whether it's Patrice Lumumba in the Congo or whether you're bringing about the downfall of Rhodesia or the South African apartheid government, you don't need a large army. But when you start invading countries with boots on the ground like Afghanistan, Iraq, now suddenly you're starting to take troops away from defense of the homeland. So what you begin to see is in 2003, more so than 2001, because we really only had in the beginning about 40,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan, you see a drain of U.S. forces on the homeland because our military, our fighting doctrine was not to ever actually have large numbers of troops on the ground. It was to do everything through surrogates. Now, all of a sudden, we're operating in a, one could almost say, an imperial doctrine with troops on the ground while still having a military whose capacity was designed for long-distance warfare fought through proxies, if that makes sense.
Sure, and of course, since 1991, when we had the Persian Gulf War, which is really the first military expansion in the United States in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union. Since that time, Russia has been rebuilt as a major military power. And of course, China has emerged as a major military power. So how does that factor into the ability of the U.S. military to defend the nation?
It impacts our defense capabilities greatly because the major problem that the United States faces today is that we have a very large empire, if you will. I mean, we have, you know, influences. We have very large influences around the world, but we don't have the military capacity to exercise the influence we want to. I mean, we talk about, oh, well, we need to bring down the North Korean regime. We need to bring down the Syrian regime. So we spread our armies all over the world to exercise influence because we can't do it through proxies anymore because the Russians and the Chinese are exercising their influence more directly. So now we spread ourselves out. We send our troops out to Jordan and Israel and South Korea and Japan. And granted, I'm fully in favor of standing up for our allies, but the problem is you can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't, on the one hand, say, we're going to defend our allies and we're going to defend the homeland, you know, and we're going to be non-interventionist. No, you have to make up your mind. Which is more important, defense of the homeland or the empire? That really, and the problem is if we acknowledge, first of all, we're an empire, we want to defend our holdings overseas, and we want to defend our homeland, we could expand our military, we could develop. I mean, we have the military capacity to do it. The problem is we're almost like somebody with schizophrenia, split personalities.
I see. We want to have an empire on some level, but we don't want to pay for it. We don't have the vast military apparatus that it would take to credibly defend the empire and at the same time be a deterrent to foreign invasion.
Exactly. Well, it's in the same vein that people don't want to acknowledge how militarily vulnerable we are. They just prefer not to think about it.
So let's go back to the basic, the most important mission of the U.S. military, which is to defend the territory of the United States. How would you start to reallocate resources to the military to enhance the defense of the United States? For example, I'm thinking of, in anticipation of a possible invasion, which we haven't had since 1812, but we did have it in 1812, and the British Army captured our capital and burned it. So, I mean, it has happened in the past, and these things, while people don't worry about it on a daily basis, it's conceivable something like that could happen again. How do you repel an invasion? We're talking about coastal defenses. What kind of things do we need?
Well, the first thing you got to do is your troops have to be trained. Bottom line, you know, a small army that's very well trained can do a lot more damage than a big army that's not very well trained. So, I mean, the first thing I would do from a budgetary perspective, people are always moaning on about how much we spend on national defense. Cut money going to the contractors. Lockheed Martin, you're not getting $350 million for a drone, okay? If we want something from you, A, we'll give you the money to research it, but you're only getting X amount. And if you don't give us a finished product that we want, you're not getting anything. And if you go out of business, too bad. That's capitalism. We'll find somebody else who can do it. You know, capitalism means that if you don't get the job done, I'm going to find somebody else.
You know, that gets
will.
Back to the famous quote from President Eisenhower in his farewell address about the undue influence of the military-industrial complex, because he saw it. He was a general. He saw these guys, because of their clout in Congress, are going to start to dictate military policy.
And that's part of the problem. So, I mean, that would be the first thing you'd have to do. And then that you would slash your defense budget by doing that. People think that the money that gets spent on defense is on veterans and college benefits. No, it's not. It goes to Obama's friends in Lockheed Martin and Boeing. The other thing I would do is I would get rid of the national security apparatus. I mean, the complex lumbering one I'd have. You know what my national security apparatus would be? You got your local police officers. Nobody knows the neighborhood, the town, and the community better than your local cops. Get rid of the Department of Homeland Security. Give funding to your local police departments. They'll do security 10 times better than DHS will. Secondly, FBI. That's what FBI is there for. Thirdly, instead of having all these complex intelligence agencies trying to gather intelligence all over the world.
These fusion centers.
Fusion
too.
Centers. Yeah. Put that in the hands of the military. That's the job of the military. And there you have three agencies, well, the CIA, of course, four agencies that would be able to do the job that we have 100 agencies doing.
And, of course, the military intelligence served that function up until the creation of the CIA after World War II.
Exactly.
It was intelligence for foreign military affairs was always a matter of the War Department, not some agency like the CIA.
Well, and even if we kept the CIA to do covert espionage, because there's certain covert espionage that the Army cannot legally do according to the Geneva Convention, but all the same, even if we kept the CIA, you get rid of all these other accessory agencies, you would be much more streamlined. Now, you want to talk about, we've streamlined everything, now we have the money to train our troops, now we have the money to build things. Like, as you asked, coastal defenses. Once you have the money to do that, now you can really start looking at where are we vulnerable. I read a great article about the fractional orbital bombardment system, FOBS, which is what they believe the North Koreans have been working on with the help of the Chinese and the Russians. We signed an agreement with the Soviets not to build these systems because it was too dangerous. It's basically a small nuclear warhead that's shot up into space, hurtles around the Earth, and explodes over a country and it sends out an EMP wave and wipes out the electrical grid.
And for those who don't know, an EMP is an electromagnetic pulse bomb.
Yep.
Which essentially destroys all the electronics of anything within a very wide area under where it's detonated. And it's detonated very high.
Exactly. It would fry everything. It only has to be a 5-kiloton warhead, which is small, and it weighs only about 50 kilos. This is not brain surgery to do this. We did not develop any defenses to protect the country against this. So we have no missile batteries on our southern border because that's where this fractional orbital bombardment system would come from. It would hurtle around the Earth, approach up through Mexico, and explode over the United States. Well, we're putting missile batteries in California, which, by the way, won't be there until 2017. Bush signed an order to put missile batteries in California. Obama canceled the order the day he came into office. Now Obama, in such haste because of North Korea, is running around going, quick, we got to get these missile batteries back. Take them from Europe. Obama should never have taken those away. That should have been point number one. Before we can defend NATO, we have to be able to defend our coastline, the missile batteries, and putting missile batteries and radar arrays on our border with Mexico. Certainly, if the Soviets knew about this in the 70s, the North Koreans, the Chinese, and the modern-day Russian Federation know about this today.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and streaming live at WPKN.org, where this program will be archived. I'm your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe, and I'm speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott-Rowe about current U.S. military policy and how it could be changed to strengthen the defense of the country. Well, you talked about the drones, the other new technology, which is the tilt of the current U.S. military doctrine. Could you talk a little bit more about the idea of technology versus boots on the ground? And what kind of training do our troops get now? What kind of training should they get?
The whole issue of technology is a totally ludicrous one. I mean, in my opinion, we invest in these drones and we say, well, drones. Drones are a politician's wet dream, to be honest. And I know it's kind of vulgar, but it's true. Because somebody like Obama looks at this and the congressmen and senators go, wow, I can kill somebody. And if a drone gets blown up, nobody cares. And certainly, you're not going to see the bodies of dead Pakistani and Afghani children on television. So, you know, or Yemeni children or Somali children. So, but people care when American soldiers get killed. So in theory, robots and drones save you having to put Americans in harm's way and save you from the political, meh.
We've spent money on robots, warriors.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. These robotic, they're not autonomous. This isn't...
The Terminator,
yeah. Which, by the way, anybody who thinks this is going to turn into the Terminator, you know, I got some coastal property in Arizona I'd like to sell you. But people are nuts. They actually believe that, you know, one day we'll have these robots that'll go fight our wars for us. Ooh.
Well, what happened with the ones they were working on at the U.S. Defense Department?
They don't
robots.
Work. They get sand in them and they jam and stop. And, you know, and then this is fundamental flaw. If you were to send out an EMP blast, zoop. all of your electrical gear runs dead.
And was a considerable amount of money spent on those guys?
Billions. Well, they spent on these robotic soldiers, and what they've spent on drones. You could have the defense budget by getting rid of these projects. The problem is, as I said, it's just too appetizing for politicians because in their mind, it means that we won't ever have to put American lives in harm's way, which means they won't ever have to answer for American deaths. And for the average American, it's a warm, fuzzy feeling because it's like, oh, well, we're not actually fighting wars. We're not actually, you know, they're safe wars. Americans aren't dying. But look, the reality is delude yourself all you want. When we fight a war against a country with a real army, e.g. Iran, North Korea, China, Russia, drones aren't going to work. They're not going to matter because they're shooting them down.
What kind of training should the average soldier be getting?
Oh, infantry training. They shouldn't be. Another problem we're facing is that our soldiers' training is greatly lacking because they're relying so much on drones. They got rid of the bayonet. Now, I don't care. People always say, I think President Obama said something to the effect of, well, in World War I, we had horses and bayonets. Well, you know, Mr. Obama, I would like to tell you, just in case, to my knowledge, you've never served in the military, and you've never heard an angry shot. So I don't think you're qualified to speak on the subject of bayonets and horses. Because let's face it, if you look at military history, especially recent military history, there was a case in Afghanistan where a group of Highlanders, a British Army Highlanders, were surrounded by the Afghans, and a bayonet charged down the hill, and the Afghans scattered. The problem is we're taking a total focus away from the individual soldier in combat, and we're focusing on the technological side. Troops aren't learning how to read maps anymore. They're learning how to use GPS. They're not learning how to fight in combat conditions. They're being taught how to operate in more regimented environments, less austere environments.
And technology dependent.
Entirely technology dependent.
How would this training compare with the training of a Russian soldier or a Chinese soldier?
Night and day. Because the thing is, the Chinese, and this is something that we ignore, and from a psychological perspective, you have to wonder if it's cognitive dissonance or if it's just stupidity, because our leadership completely ignores the fact that the Chinese and the Russians have been training for conventional all-out ground war for decades. Moreover, the Chinese Defense Ministry said all their training is oriented towards fighting the United States. This was the Chinese Defense Ministry. This was their one of the lead professors, a commandant at the Chinese War College, said that we are training, all of our plans are focused on fighting the United States. So the Chinese infantryman is trained to fight. They do a lot of hand-to-hand. The Chinese love hand-to-hand. We as Americans don't do hand-to-hand. We teach combatives. And the problem with the U.S. Army combatives is it's all designed, you know, somebody grabs your rifle, you push them away, roll them away so you can free your weapon. The Chinese troops train to kill with their bare hands. Same thing goes for the Russians. It's just two different, totally different styles of approach. And the problem is that when you become so technology dependent, what do you do when your weapon fails? What do you do when your weapon system fails? What do you do when your aircraft fails? And the thing is, the Russians and the Chinese at the end of the day train to march through the woods, you know, sleep in really austere Spartan conditions, engage and destroy the enemy. And that for us is a problem. We are fully capable of meeting the enemy in the battlefield and destroying them if we train to that standard. But if we don't train to that standard, we're never going to be able to defeat an enemy that's actually trained for war. I mean, that's history.
How does the weapon that's issued to the average American infantryman stack up against those possessed by Russian and Chinese soldiers?
Well, again, this is part of the huge problem we have, is that in addition to the training being inadequate, our weapon systems are inadequate. Again,
what is the basic weapon issued to an American infantryman?
It's the M4 carbine. And
this is a successor to the M16, which was used in Vietnam at the 223 caliber?
Yes. Well, you had the M16A1 in Vietnam, then you had the A2 up until about 2004, when they really started issuing out the M4 a lot.
So the M4 is sort of a cut-down version of the M16?
It's a cut-down version. The biggest problem with the weapons system, and like I say, this is indicative of the problems throughout our defense industry, we invest in things that'll get certain individuals wealthy. I mean, because the decisions over what weapons are bought are not made by generals. If they were made by generals, the U.S. military would have the best weapons in the world. The problem is they're made by members of the Senate Budgeting Committee and the Senate Armed Services Committee, who are getting donations from Colt and Lockheed Martin and so on and so forth.
So what can you tell us about the M4's defects or assets?
Well, its asset is it's small and compact. It's a very comfortable weapon to fire, but its biggest defect is it jams, which is a fundamental flaw. The M16 and M4 series of weapons jam incessantly. The problem is the parts are made really fine. They're way too close together, so you get a grain of sand in there, and it scratches the thing up, and it jams. Now, you want to compare that with, let's say, any of the Kalashnikov series of weapons, and those were unique in that the parts were made very far apart. Now, the Kalashnikov is not as accurate as the M16, although probably comparable to the M4. So let's say we take the latest Kalashnikov, right? Because there are thousands of variants, and, you know, I can't umbrella all of them under one. But let's say we take the AKM, right? Newer model, I believe it's the AK-105, I'm sorry. That's the latest one used by the Russian military. And I saw this weapon in testings, and it floored me. The way they tested this weapon, they sandblasted it, soaked it, sandblasted it again, froze it, fired it, heated it up to like some unbelievable like 140 degrees, fired it. I mean, the thing will endure. They dropped it out of a moving vehicle. They ran over it with a moving vehicle. The thing still fired. An M4, if you get a little sand in it, it'll foul up completely. The parts of any AK-105, any AKM, AK-74, AK-47, they're all interchangeable. Meaning that if my weapon breaks, which I've yet to see happen, but let's say it broke, I could literally take it apart and pull a bolt out of somebody else's rifle, put it in mine, and it would work. You do that with any M16 or M4 series weapon, the thing will foul up. It'll never function right again. The parts are not interchangeable.
So we could improve on this basic infantry weapon.
Oh, incredibly. And it's not that we have to go out and start buying Kalashnikovs, but let's face it, Mikhail Kalashnikov came up with a good idea, and we could try to build off of that. The other thing is the German weapons are phenomenal, too.
What do they use?
They use the G36 assault rifle, which is phenomenal. It's plastic magazines, very durable, very rugged. It's complex, like most German weapons are, but you never need to take it apart because it doesn't break.
I take it that no one around the world uses the M4?
No. There are third world armies in Africa that still use the FN FAL, which is a Belgian weapon, from the 70s and 60s over the M16. Because the M16 and the M4, it's a crappy weapon. I mean, I'm red, white, and blue American as much as, as much as the next person, but I'm kvetching because I think that as a patriotic American, our soldiers should be issued weapons so they can meet and kill the enemy, not so that they can make some few bucks for some defense contractor that happens to be friends with President Obama.
Now, we've talked about the training of the average infantryman, the kind of equipment he's been using. Can we talk a little about the way our army is organized? Traditionally, I'd say up until World War I, we had an organization based upon locality, local regiments, so that everybody in your community would belong to the same unit. And somewhere along the line, that changed. So now, when you go in the army, you're with people from all over the country, and there's no anymore any connection between the unit and a town. Is this a bad development or a good one? What's the point?
Oh, it's a terrible development. It's a terrible development. I mean, one of the things that I think is interesting is when you look at most armies around the world, right? And this, you know, the U.S. military is an example. But let's say you look at the British military, right? And that's my favorite example. The British military is organized along regiments based locally. So let's say you are from Enniskillen, right, in Northern Ireland, you would join an Enniskillen branch of the Irish Royal Irish Regiment. If you were from Scotland, you would join a local branch of, you know, the Royal Highland Fusiliers, the King's Own Scottish Borderers, the Black Watch. You would find a regiment that was near where you lived, and that's the one you would join. All of these regiments, I mean, there are so many. My brain's kind of picking through them, but there's a lot of them, you know.
They have a long tradition, right? That's and a strong sense of esprit.
Exactly. Well, in addition, the esprit, the history. I mean, if you're a member of the Royal Fusiliers, which is a very elite regiment, you remember the Royal Fusiliers, you have a very high esprit because you trace your heritage back 300 years, 400 years. The other thing, though, also is you're local. You're probably from, unless you, because the Fusiliers, like any of the Guards regiments, have a lot of legend behind them. You might travel a long ways to join them. But let's say you live locally, you would most likely join a local regiment. You would have local esprit because you'd be like, oh, this is like Glasgow's own, you know, in many ways.
Would they be stationed in Glasgow or no?
Yeah, there are regiments all across Britain that are stationed locally. They're all stationed locally. Now, this is at two assets. One, you have a very high esprit because you're all from the same area, you all have something in common, and you have a very ancient heritage. The other thing is that if you're ever invaded, nobody knows that territory better than you do. And that's something that the North Koreans do that we don't do. The North Korean regiments are organized along a local system. They're special forces, namely. I don't know about the rest of the North Korean army because we know so little. It's an information black hole. But the North Korean special forces are all organized locally. And the idea, they have about 600,000 special forces that we know of. And the idea is that if the United States were to invade North Korea, you grew up in this town, you were born in this town, raised in this town, you can fight, you know every blade of grass, you could fight behind every rock because you know the territory. Now, let's flip over to the United States. Our army is not organized along a regimental basis. It is scattered across the country, and people from Georgia will be serving in New York, and people from New York will be serving in Missouri. Well, the problem is, if we were to be invaded, you really think a soldier from Missouri is going to know anything about fighting in New York City?
And would his heart be in it? When he knows that Missouri may be getting hammered.
Exactly. Would his heart really be in it? So you really have that double problem there. The other thing is also you don't have the esprit anymore either, because you have a few elite units like 101st Airborne, Air Assault. You have 82nd Airborne and, the Rangers and a few units like that. The vast majority of the Army, though, there isn't that esprit because, again, a guy from Georgia is serving with a unit from New Mexico or California. What the hell does he have in common with these guys? The thing is the units that you find with the most esprit are the National Guard. Because, the idea of the National Guard and the reserve units, but particularly the Guard, because they're like, Connecticut's own, New England's own kind of a thing.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and streaming live at WPKN.org, where this program will be archived. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. And I'm speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe about current U.S. military policy and how it could be changed to strengthen the defense of the country. Well, if you're going to reorganize the Army into regimental units, would you do that? Be able to do that on active duty, or would that be something you'd only do with the Guard and Reserves?
Oh, I would do it on an active duty level. Absolutely. I mean, it would allow for people to serve full time, and I think it would increase the appeal of active duty for most people. Because the problem is, okay, yeah, if you're from the South, going active duty and staying in the South isn't a big deal. But if you're from New York, or Michigan, or Indiana, or Connecticut, or New Hampshire, or Vermont, and you're thinking you want to go in the military, well, why the heck are you going to go get stationed in Georgia? You're from New York City, right? Culture Center. Why the hell are you going to go to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri or Fort Polk? But if you have a locally based regiment and you want to serve locally, you go active duty, you serve with a local active duty, and it would also build a stronger bond between the active duty and the reserve and the guard. Because when the reserve and the guard go to train, they'll train with the active duty.
Just to put in perspective, what's about the approximate size of the U.S. military today?
The U.S. Army is about 500,000 standing active duty and with about 1 million or so reserves. So about 1.5 million all in all.
And the reservists years ago were kept in reserve at home. They weren't sent to Vietnam. But starting with the Persian Gulf War, reservists essentially have been used liberally in foreign wars, kind of like an army on the cheap. You only pay them a very small amount of money when they're not in war. And you're only paying full wages when they're activated and sent abroad to fight in a war. Is that a good way of using your Guard and Reserve, especially if we go back to our original premise that the principal mission of the U.S. military is defend the homeland? Should we be rethinking the way we use the Guard and the Reserves?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The way we use our military today is moronic because we say, well, we want to cut down on the active duty force. So we're going to have all these reservists and we'll send them and we'll send the Guard. Then who's going to be left to defend the homeland? Whether it's a hurricane or an invasion or a terrorist attack, you need these guys back home. First of all, they should be merged into one. We should have a territorial army. One of the problems we have is Americans love bureaucracy. Americans love bureaucracy. We have 8 different national security agencies. Forget it. Have one territorial army. That is your Guard and Reserve. They're locally based. They train with the active duty. The active duty are your full-timers who themselves are locally based. on a regimental level. They'd have a, you know, high esprit de corps, Connecticut 51st Infantry, you know. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, too, it would be a much larger army because it would be locally based. It would also take some of the burden for funding off of the federal government, because the states would have an interest in funding their local regiment, because it'd be part of the pride for the state. Example, the Connecticut governor wouldn't want his local regiment to go underfunded. He might throw in for the local regiment. It would take some of the funding burden off of the federal government, and strategically it would help a lot.
The territorial force would be restricted to duty at home. Would that be the idea?
Yes, basically, because if you were ever forced to have conscription, they wouldn't get conscripted into the territorial army. So your territorials in Britain, if you go into the British Ministry of Defense website, when you look at their recruitment page, they have full-time soldier, part-time soldier. That's it. You're either a full-timer or a part-timer. If you're a part-timer, you're a territorial army. Full-timer, you're active duty. If you're territorial army, you're going to serve at home. That's
so basically these guys aren't being grabbed and their units aren't being told to go to Iraq or whatever.
No, but the whole idea of the territorial army is different than, you know, than what we have with our Guard and Reserve. Because the idea of the territorial army is Britain's been invaded, let's face it, since before 1066. I mean, we go back to the time of the Romans, you know, before the Anglo-Saxons. You know, Britain's been invaded repeatedly. So their idea of the territorial army is, you know, essential, because their entire army was overseas. They get conquered. Whereas for us, we really don't think about it. And I think what we'd have to do is we'd have to have a territorial army who would defend our borders. Now, if a major war broke out, we need manpower. Well, first of all, I'm a firm believer in national service. I'm a firm believer in national service. And because I feel that if you have national service, you don't need to call up your territorial army, your reserve, and your guard, because you have a lot of soldiers. The other reason why I believe in national service, people think a heck of a lot harder about going to war when their own children are in the military, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things I find interesting is I talk to people nowadays, and I say, you know, well, you know, I know people that are getting deployed, and they go, where? I say, Afghanistan. They go, oh, are we still at war there? Well, and the only reason is not because they're particularly dumb. It's because they have no reason to think about it. But if we had national service, it would increase the size of our military, our capability to defend ourselves, like Switzerland. And at the same time, people wouldn't be as eager to go to war because everybody would be involved. Well, everybody would have a stake.
Let's assume we have an all-volunteer force. What would attract people to serve in this new territorial force? Would there be a social aspect to it, like there was with the, you know, in the 19th century with the local guard units?
Well, militias? There would be. There definitely would be a esprit de corps, like with any regiment of the British Army. The thing that we have, though, and this is, I mean, would require a massive social change, is that this force, not just the territorials, but the new active duty regimental based system, would also require a massive media campaign. You would need the media to stop discouraging military service, because that's one of the big problems we have in our society. I heard John Kerry, and I was appalled when I heard this, because, you know, I know many veterans that have PhDs, but John Kerry said most soldiers are college dropouts. And so one of the problems is that so long as you propagate this image that the military is just for the downtrodden and the underachievers, you'll never be able to recruit many people.
Let's just paint a picture of what this new territorial force would look like. I assume there would be a facility, maybe shared by the active duty and the territorials, which would have to be within a reasonable drive of where a person lived, right? And the idea would be, on my block, it's very likely there would be at least one person who was a member of this territorial force.
That's why I say, though, it has to take a social shift.
So now, I know John, who lives three doors down, is in the territorial force. I see him in his uniform. I see him. I know he drives to, let's say, 10, 15 miles to this facility, which I've seen it myself. Maybe he's shown it to me. So now I have a familiarity with the military that's defending my community.
Well, absolutely. But like I say, the first thing we have to do is destigmatize military service, because otherwise that's never going to happen.
Well, certainly if you go back to the militia, and I have some militia officers in my family in the mid-19th century, and that was a very important local social institution as well as a military institution. And everybody who was anybody wanted to be an officer in the local militia.
And it was that way up until Vietnam. After post-Vietnam, it was stigmatized. And like I say, what John Kerry said was indicative of what's been pumped into the American mainstream.
So it is realistic to try to bring back this institution, especially, it seems to me, if people know they're not going to be sent willy-nilly to fight a war in Africa or the Middle East. If they know that their function is, they're going to be stay in their community and their function is to train to defend their community. And I assume, if I can go on, Marshawn, wouldn't the training be locally focused? In other words, we wouldn't send this person 2,000 miles away to train to fight in a terrain which was completely unlike his home community.
Well, you want your soldiers to be diverse. You want these guys to be able to go to California to stop a Chinese invasion.
I see. Even so the territorials.
Though, of course, because the territorial is not just in charge of defending his home, especially in a country this large.
So what would his training look like? Let's say I'm joining the territorials. I do whatever it is, 8 weeks of basic training. I go away from
10 weeks, actually.
10 weeks. I go away from the community. What kind of training? What's the
emphasis? Absolutely.
Is it infantrymen or what kind of stuff do they teach you?
Well, every soldier is an infantryman, so everyone would have to learn how to be an infantryman first. Because even if you're a lawyer, you know, you might find yourself in a position where, hey, we're giving you a gun and you're going to the front.
So there might be less specialization in this territorial force and
be specialization. That's the way it is today.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone goes to basic training as an infantryman first.
Yes.
I mean, like I say, the most fundamental thing that has to change before anything else is we have to have a social shift and eliminate the stigmatization of military service so that this way people will look at service in the territorial force as honorable. They'll say, okay, well, I got to go away to California for 2 weeks for training, but it's honorable and noble. National defense is not just a physical military issue. It's a social issue. We have to get people thinking on the importance, because for this territorial force to work, you have to have local participation. So you have to get people thinking that, hey, you have a stake in this too. And you have to get people thinking that you're going to go away for training. You're going to go spend 9 weeks of basic training. It's going to suck. You're going to get yelled at and screamed at. It's going to be a lot of work. But you're going to want to do this because you want to defend your local community. And once you've completed your basic training, you are now a tool to defend your home, to defend your neighbors. You're not going to go abroad to Afghanistan. You're not going to go abroad to Iraq, but you're going to be able to defend your
house. People are going to know who you are. Yeah, when you go to church, they're going to know that so-and-so is a lieutenant in the local unit. And he's going to have, I would think, a connection with his community and respect from the community.
If we have this social change. That's what I'm trying to say. Because one of the things that you see, a very stark contrast, is you travel to the South, whether it's even the Southwest, and you say, I'm in the military, there's like a, there's an automatic respect. Whereas in the Northeast, and I've noticed this myself from people I've known have been in the military, you say, wow, you're in the military, and people look at you like, chump. And that's part of the problem. And we have to get past that stigmatization. We have to make military service is an honorable, respectable field. It is something that's every citizen's responsibility. And that way, if you make it everybody's responsibility, it becomes like being a volunteer fireman. I think that's the end goal that we're getting to here. The territorial army is going to be like the volunteer fire department. Maybe they have a shorter basic training. I mean, it doesn't have to be 10 weeks. Yes. They don't have to necessarily go through the same intensity basic training. But the idea is that these military service needs to be honorable, it needs to be respectable, and it needs to be something that's considered a duty of every citizen, again, like being a volunteer fireman.
Now, we talked about, as you developed this idea of a territorial force, locally based, community-oriented, we've talked about the facilities, which would presumably be nearby.
Of course, they'd have to be, otherwise.
Let's look at the U.S., the location of current U.S. military installations. Where are they? How do they fit into this primary function of defending the United States?
The way our forces are set up in the United States is beyond backwards. It blows my mind when I think about it. Most of our forces are located in the southern United States, in places like Missouri, Georgia, South Carolina, California.
Why are they in these places?
Because of congressmen, basically. Some governor's connections, and they say, well, we want to build a new fort, and some guy says, hey, my state could use the revenue. So they put it there. No strategic thinking whatsoever. And that's why, I mean...
So say that again. These bases are not picked because they're strategically located in places where we have to defend some critical resource, like a harbor or railroad juncture or something like
that. No, not at all. They're placed in the middle of nowhere. And like I say, a lot of it has to do with some important governor, senator, or congressman.
I'm thinking that before the War of 1812, people from New York, they know Battery Park. And down there is something that was called Castle Clinton, which was erected in conjunction with something called Castle Williams on Governor's Island before the War of 1812 to protect New York Harbor. And I was lucky New York wasn't attacked like Washington, but the people were prepared.
Absolutely. And that's the way it's supposed to be. But one of the things you see happening, especially now, is forces are scattered all across the United States. They're not strategically located, and moreover, they're isolated. What you generally want to do is locate your forces on either a high ground, locate your bases on a high ground, on a hill, on a high hill or mountain, or locate your forces near urban centers. The problem is when you stick a fort out in the middle of flipping Missouri, what's going to happen in the event of a major war is it's going to be promptly bombed the heck out of and then surrounded. That's, again, military history. There is no precedence in military history for placing your troops out in the middle of nowhere. It just means that it makes them easier to bomb. It makes them easier to surround, isolate, and cut off. The reason why you want to put them on mountaintops, on high ground, is because those positions are easy to defend. The reason why you want them next to urban centers is because your urban centers are strategically the most important, and because your urban centers are presumably where all your supplies are going to come from. Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, you're in the middle of nowhere. You get surrounded by the Chinese army. Well, you're not going to be going up to defend New York or Chicago or LA. Now you're trapped and surrounded.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and streaming live at WPKN.org, where this program will be archived. You can also check us out on Facebook at In Context Report and watch our videos on the In Context Report YouTube channel. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe about current U.S. military policy and how it could be changed to strengthen the defense of the country.
There are no resources there, so you're just going to be starved out.
Now, we've talked about the reorganization of the regiments of the Army, about training versus technology, about the relocation of our bases. When you look at the perspective of the primary function of the military, defending the territory of the United States, let's revisit technology. What are the most important technological features in terms that would be useful in defending the United States from an invasion, say?
Well, you know, a lot of it goes back to the Cold War. It's sonar arrays to prevent submarines from slipping and getting onto our coast and launching missiles. The other thing that's very important is development of early warning systems. We don't have early warning systems anymore, which means if I were a Chinese naval commander and I plop my sub right off the U.S. coast and I launched it, or let's say alternatively, I'm the North Koreans and I lob a missile at the United States, that missile goes to head to, flying to L.A. There is no early warning system. They might, on the news, go, holy, the missile's going into L.A. There are no air raid sirens. There are no air raid shelters. You'd have a lot of people killed just due to the fact that we don't want to think about the fact that it could happen.
How about the EMP situation?
Well, that's another thing that I was going to go into, hardening our electrical grid against EMP attacks. Seems kind of rudimentary, but it would
again,
only...
one blast of a small nuclear bomb way up over the United States could knock out our electronic system.
And millions die from starvation because
nothing
works.
And,
exactly.
And the only people who can talk to each other are, I guess, the leaders in the Washington.
The Pentagon and the White House, and that's it. Those are the only two installations. I don't know if NORAD's even hardened, the Northern Command. The problem, according to popular science, it would only cost around $100 million to harden our entire infrastructure. So this isn't expensive, what I'm talking about. The other thing is setting up defensive plans. When you talk about reallocating our bases, they should be allocated in terms of defensive lines. The Blue Ridge Mountains, the Missouri River, the idea that if we get invaded from, let's say, the West, the Chinese would have to get through this defensive line, that defensive line, this defensive line, that defensive line. And then similarly, if we got invaded from the East, the Blue Ridge Mountains would be a defensive line, that kind of thing, the Appalachian Mountains. The other thing that would be important on a smaller level would be that your National Guard and your reserve units have concrete, sandbags, and tank traps. The idea being that, and shovels. And again, it sounds really rudimentary, but it is.
So these would be to dig entrenchments. Would you also construct bunkers and that sort of thing?
Exactly. If you have concrete, You can instruct bunkers overnight. If you have concertina wire, barbed wire, you can set up obstacles overnight. Shovels, you can dig trenches really quick. I mean, you can have improvised defensive networks up real fast. So the other thing would be to have these on the books, would be to have these defensive plans in the books so that you could implement them and then have the resources to be able to implement them. And again, agreements with your local police departments and fire departments to evacuate people that would be in the line of these defensive lines, in the way of these defensive lines.
And I don't want people to think that we are suggesting that an invasion of the United States is going to happen tomorrow, but you do have fire insurance on your house. And it's extremely unlikely, if you live in the suburbs, your house is going to burn down. But you take precautions. And we're talking here about the safety of 300 million Americans and the independence of the United States. Seems to me you take reasonable precautions.
Well, you know, it's like David Mitchell, the British comedian, once said, you don't need to have proof that it's happening for it to not be worth doing something about. We need to have proof that it's never going to happen for it to be worth doing nothing about. You know, it's not like you're ever going to say to somebody, I know it's getting hot in here and we're having difficulty breathing and your theory is that the roof might be on fire, but until I have proof, I'm not going to extinguish my cigar. If you think something bad's about to happen, you plan for it, you prepare for it. You don't ignore the fact that it could potentially happen. I mean, this isn't like getting volcano insurance. It's like getting flood insurance. Yeah, you know what? You live in a low-lying area. Chances are your house might never flood, even if you live in a low-lying area. But you acknowledge the fact that just because you live in a low-lying area, you might get flooded. Let's face it. We live in a dangerous neighborhood. You have a lot of countries that want to hurt us, a lot of organizations and individuals that want to hurt us.
And certainly the current military expansion that's been going on really since 1991 with the Persian Gulf War has brought us closer and closer to the rising power of China and the renewed power of Russia as we confront Russia in particular in the Mideast and China in the Pacific over the Korean Peninsula and Japan.
We went after Saddam Hussein because we thought he might have chemical weapons. He might have weapons of mass destruction, CBRN. And, you know, we thought he might have that, so we went after him. And we thought he might use them against us or our allies.
And it turned out China, it was wrong.
China has openly said that their military strategy is to use their weapons against us. And we're going, well, you know.
Let's not go there.
Let's not think about it. And that's part of the problem is that just burying your head in the sand doesn't change the facts of the situation. If you live in an area where your house might get flooded as those waters are rising around your feet, to close your eyes and go, it's not happening, it's not happening, it's not happening, I'm in my happy place, isn't going to change anything.
Well, in the closing minutes of this very interesting discussion, I'd like to talk maybe a little bit about that scenario which you alluded to. Let's say the Russians invade from the east, the Chinese from the west, maybe there's an EMP attack that precedes it to knock out our electronics. Can we, for example, with coastal batteries, prevent landings of foreign troops? Is there any way to prevent these very advanced stealth submarines, which we know the Russians have, from lobbing missiles into an American city? Can that be stopped?
Absolutely. As I mentioned, we start reinvesting in our sonar nets. We invest in our Navy. I mean, Mr. President, I have some breaking news for you. Battleships and horses and bayonets have not gone out of style. Because let's face it, at the end of the day, the Russians have a new submarine. And folks, you can look this up. It's called the Borei submarine. The Russians claim to have three of them. I think they have more because nobody ever puts out on Wikipedia exactly how many submarines they have. These are stealth submarines. They run silent. We need destroyers. We need cruisers. We need ships that can sail around our coastline and detect these things. Now, obviously, these submarines are very hard to detect because they have a silent drive. They run silent. They use jet propulsion underwater. It's virtually impossible to hear them, but you still, you know, you have a much greater chance of hearing it if you have ships out there than having none at all. The other thing is, like, as I mentioned, having these coastal defenses, having these defensive lines. Let's say we don't stop them when they hit the beach. We fall back to a second defensive line. The problem we have is that if we don't heed the warnings of history, if we don't look at the fact that ignoring a problem doesn't make it go away, if we don't ignore the threat of China, China can field more soldiers than we have American citizens. People think we're such a large country, nobody would ever want to invade us. Well, no, it's just because we had such a large population. But now, China's population alone is 1.2, 1.4 billion. Their military right now, standing, that means currently under arms, is 27 million.
If they called I think you said before ours was, what, 1.5 million, including the reserves?
Ish. And they're 27 million standing. If they call up their guard and their militia, you would have an army of 350 million.
That's versus 1.5 million.
And versus more people than we have. And if they combined with the likes of Russia, I mean, if they combined with the likes of Russia, North Korea, Iran, let's say the BRICS countries, India, South Africa, I mean, you're really looking at the very real possibility that we would just be swarmed.
So they succeed in landing. They would drive, I'm guessing, up major highways towards cities. Would that
absolutely
be?
Driving inland. I mean, there's still a mechanized.
And
army,
am I also
presumably.
Right to say that once they captured cities, they pretty much would be over?
Oh, absolutely. And we also have to understand that the Chinese in particular are brutal. I mean, you look at their occupation of Tibet, they don't play nice. You know, they're not above going into an American city and killing half the population. The other thing is the Chinese are also not above being settlers either. So if the Chinese took land, it would be to stay. They would come in, they would kill a portion of the population, then they move in a million Chinese farmers. I mean, think about this for a second. Imagine if you were to take the state of Ohio, right? And you were to kill a large portion of the population, and you're a country of 1.4 billion, you could move in 2 million Chinese into the state.
Or if you took, say, a plain state where there's a very sparsely populated.
Utah has a population of less than a million. You bring in 2 million Chinese, all of a sudden, now you've completely forever changed the demographics of that state.
Sure.
So, I mean, this isn't beyond the realm of possibility for a country as big as China. And don't give me the whole, the Chinese need us for as a market. They don't anymore. We're bankrupt. They know we're bankrupt. The only thing they can get from us is our physical land. I mean, once it's sucked you dry, it's then going to take you for whatever's left, well,
you
which
know,
is your life.
We talked earlier about the desirability of creating a territorial force through a combination of the Guard and Reserves, a force which would be dedicated towards the defense of the territory of the United States instead of being deployed abroad. How would they fit into an invasion scenario? Would untrained civilians be of any use to them? Sometimes people say, oh, we have 300 million guns in America, so people will be shooting at invaders right and left. How would the territorial force work into the picture, and would other armed civilians be of any use?
Armed civilians, generally speaking, and I hate to tell people this because, I mean, I'm as pro-Second Amendment as the next person, but the problem is that fundamentally there is no substitute for actual combat training. And we saw that in Germany with the Volkssturm. When the Soviets invaded, they had millions of German civilians that they just gave guns to and said, fight, and they got slaughtered. The fact is that the reason why you would have the territorial armies, these are people with rudimentary knowledge of the military. They have their own guns. And the thing is, when you have one person who's trained, he can take 20 civilians who own guns and train them. The problem is, if you have 20 civilians who have no training and go out and start taking pot shots at the Chinese, they're just going to get slaughtered.
And in turn, the territorial force might include former active duty soldiers who returned home, who would have greater experience.
Absolutely. And they would be able to impart that to civilians. So, yeah, we have 350 million guns, but if those people don't receive any kind of training in combat training, just because you shoot a weapon doesn't mean you can stop a professional army. Because make no mistake, the Chinese are a professional army. The only way those 350 million guns will be of any use is if these people receive some kind of rudimentary training. And if they don't, the Chinese will just, you know, steamroll across the United States.
Well, I think, as we said, we don't see this invasion as imminent, but it seems to me that any prudent country ought to take precautions to ensure that it does everything it can to meet an invasion, if such an invasion should occur. But also, wouldn't it be useful to argue that if we're well prepared for an invasion, it would deter people who might be thinking of attacking us?
Well, yeah, think about it. Nobody's ever invaded Switzerland, you know, and that's part of it because Switzerland is militarized, and that's another reason why I'm a big fan of national service. You don't have
but
to
every
go train.
Every Swiss man has a rifle in his house, right? That he has some military
and
training.
Every Swiss man has military training. That's the point. And that's what I'm saying. If we had 350 million firearms in the United States, awesome. If each one of those 350 million firearms is served in the military, even for just a brief period of time, gone to basic training, now you basically have 350 million soldiers. And well, that's the fundamental difference.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, Marshawn, but thank you very much for sharing your views with us.
It's my pleasure.
You've been listening to In Context War Report. I'm your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe, and I've been speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott-Rowe about the need for significant change in U.S. military policy to strengthen the nation's defenses. In Context is produced by MDR Productions, Inc. and is broadcast on non-commercial, listener-sponsored WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And it streams at WPKN.org, where In Context programs are archived for free listening. You're invited to visit us on Facebook at In Context Report and watch our videos on YouTube on the In Context Report channel. Our email is in context at WPKN.org. Thanks for joining us on In Context. See you next time.